This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a GHIL lecture by Christine Krüger, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at the University of Bonn, on analyzing reconciliation and irreconcilability from a historical perspective, the example of Germany and Britain. Whether in a global political context or within society, irreconcilability seems to be the hallmark of our present times. This explains the growing interest in reconciliation processes. Since the 1990s, reconciliation has been an established field of research in political science. Historians, however, have explored this field only to a limited extent, although the topic should be an obvious one for them, as the call for reconciliation always relates to the past. Political science analyses of reconciliation or irreconcilability usually concentrate on political explanations. They pay little attention to social or economic, and even less to cultural factors. This is where historical research can contribute to a better understanding. The aim of the lecture is to shed light on the potential of historical reconciliation research, with a particular focus on the entangled history of Germany and Great Britain.
Thank you very much for the friendly presentation and for inviting me here. I'm very happy to be able to present here my, ongoing research project, which is just about to take forms. And I would like to start this talk with an episode from my family history. In 1966, my newly married parents traveled to England. My father combined this holiday trip with his professional interests. He was a town planner, and so, armed with a camera, my parents visited Stevenage, which aroused his interest as a new town. When my father took pictures of a school building that he thought was architecturally remarkable, the headmaster took notice. He approached my parents, gave them a tour of the school, and eventually invited them to his home, where they could stay overnight. The friendship between the headmaster couple and my parents lasted a lifetime. Several reciprocal visits followed. My parents were impressed by the spontaneous hospitality. Today, it fascinates me from the point of an historian. Was this kind of hospitality something extraordinary in the mid-1960s? Would it have been possible in West Germany or in France? Or was it a peculiarity of everyday English culture? And if so, what role did it play in the German-British reconciliation process? My parents perceived the hospitality of their English friends as something very special. To what extent is this perception connected with the German or to the German past? My mother doesn't remember whether the conversation turned to the recent German history during her first stay in Stevenage. However, she told us as children that her father, who had already traveled abroad as an English and French teacher in the 1950s, sometimes confronted with harsh hostility, especially in France. And she herself had been moved by the fact that on her first school exchange to England in 1958 and during her au pair visit to France a few years later, she had stayed with families whose members had gone to war against Germany. This is why I wonder whether and to what extent my parents interpreted their hospitality in Stevenage in 1966 against the background of the German past. When were such individual or also organized encounters possible without thinking about the former enmity between the two nations? If we consult historical research on this question, we get no real answer. We might have some anecdotes from the family memory or from the communicative memory. Moreover, in the political sphere, the Franco-German friendship is celebrated as the cornerstone of European unification. For these reasons, the European reconciliation process may seem familiar at first glance. However, historical research on the topic is still meager. In the following, I'm going to formulate a few suggestions for future research on the topic. I will concentrate on the example of Britain and Germany, but I will always have the Franco-German case in mind also to have a contrast agent to compare to the Franco-British case. After a few more introductory words, I will then go on to give some hints on where the reconciliation research can go on, in which direction it can go on. And I will focus here on motivations for reconciliation, on practices of reconciliation, and on conditions that determined its outcome. If reconciliation, as well as reconcilability or irreconcilability, have so far been relatively rarely the focus of historical research, this distinguishes historiography from other academic disciplines. In political science, for example, reconciliation has already become widely established as a subject of analysis. Perhaps the historian's reticence is due to the fact that they generally emphasize changeability and are therefore usually skeptical of normative concepts. The religious connotation of the term reconciliation, which is even stronger with the German word Versöhnung, may also have been relevant here. It is indeed a task and a challenge for reconciliation research to search for conceptual equivalents that can be used to translate the term into languages or cultures that are not characterized by the Jewish or Christian religion. However, the conceptual difficulties should not lead historians to refrain from making reconciliation a subject of research. In view of the tense global political situation, but also in view of the increasing polarization of many Western societies, the topic is too important. Previous historical research in this era has pursued two main goals. On the one end, it was concerned with examining and, if necessary, modifying the ideas of universality or universally valid models of reconciliation processes, as they are often invoked in politics, but also in political sciences. By sharpening the awareness of the historical boundedness and changeability of the concepts of reconciliation, historians can help to critically scrutinize normative assumptions. This seems particularly important because politicians hope that such models will provide concrete instructions for action. This leads us to the second objective of previous historical research on reconciliation. In recent years, historians have increasingly endeavored to identify and deconstruct myths that have formed around reconciliation processes. The Franco-German post-war history can serve as an example of such a myth, which politicians like to point to as a model for a successful reconciliation process. This myth-making is a favorite subject of study for historians. Another objective is less common in historical reconciliation research, but in my view, it makes the topic particularly relevant at present. Reconciliation research can and should also contribute to the understanding of our present. The idea of reconciliation has always been considered as a strong cementing force of the European idea or the European integration. If we ask ourselves today why enthusiasm for Europe is crumbling and Eurosceptics or even Europhobes are gaining support, we will not find an answer without also analyzing reconciliation and irreconcilability. Two master narratives define the history of Western European and especially West German reconciliation. The first, more pessimistic master narrative, explains the achievement of reconciliation with the Cold War and the integration of the West. A new enemy had forced old hostilities to be overcome. Those who highlight this motivation are primarily emphasizing the politics of interest and tend to locate reconciliation in the political sphere. Charles de Gaulle, for example, explicitly stressed this motivation during his week-long state visit to Germany in 1962, and historians often take over this interpretation. The second somewhat more optimistic master narrative emphasizes the widespread longing for peace. According to this reading, efforts to create a lasting peace were a reaction to the growing destructive power or potential of war through mechanization and brutalization after the war. A long line of development is sometimes drawn here, the emergence of international humanitarian law at the end of the 19th century, the founding of the League of Nations after the First World War and the United Nations after the Second World War, all seen as reactions to brutalization of the war in general. These master narratives both focus on political history and the history of civil society. This is also the focus of historical research up to date or today. However, historiography has so far paid too little attention to questions of cultural and emotional history, and it still leaves many questions unanswered. Was there a golden age of reconciliation, and if so, when? What were the conditions and factors of success or failure? How can the intensity be assessed? What are the consequences of various reconciliation initiatives? I will now come to some definitions of reconciliation. Common definitions distinguish reconciliation from peace. They assume that reconciliation goes beyond a mere peace agreement and, in contrast to the latter, is based on the mutual willingness to overcome enmity, whereas a peace agreement can also be imposed. According to common definitions, reconciliation is primarily based on the establishment of cooperative or even friendly relations between the former parties to the conflict. Many definitions emphasize the apparent paradox that reconciliation is both a process and a state. If we choose a historical perspective, it is first of all noticeable that although reconciliation as a religious commandment is centuries old, the idea of collective reconciliation is a historically recent phenomenon. It is true that reconciliation was also invoked after armed conflicts in the early modern period, for example, in the context of the Peace of Westphalia. However, it was then understood as the individual reconciliation of the rulers. A prerequisite of the idea of a collective reconciliation is the idea of collective enmity, as it emerged with nationalism in the 19th century. What is important here is the idea that a larger community bears, or at least shares, responsibility for the conflict. This was the case when warfare was nationalized. In the 19th century, however, we first find the idea of collective reconciliation in an inner national conflict or context, namely in the aftermath of the American Civil War. In the aftermath of the numerous other wars of the 19th century, the idea of collective reconciliation did not yet emerge. It was only shortly before the First World War that adherents of the peace movement began to formulate the idea of a necessary reconciliation of conflicting parties and former warfare enemies as a political goal, and they were the first to launch the first initiatives with this objective. The idea of national reconciliation is based on the nation as a collective actor, in a sense personifying the nation. Just like the nation itself, reconciliation is a construction. But it is a construction that can develop power and initiate its own dynamics. We can speak of a reconciliation process when the idea of reconciliation materializes in certain practices. As mentioned, one of the main motives for reconciliation initiatives after 1945 was the widespread desire to create lasting peace after the experience of the two world wars. The desire is undoubtedly expressed in numerous sources. It can be found in reconciliation initiatives from civil society or as a justification for government action. However, this should not lead us to see the connection between the experience of war and the willingness to reconcile as an inevitability. A pronounced longing for peace does not necessarily go hand in hand with the idea of reconciliation or the idea that reconciliation is possible or desirable. There were numerous victims of the Nazi terror and of German war crimes who were convinced that reconciliation with Germany was impossible. That's important to remember. For example, the survivors of the French village of Oradour-sur-Glane, they were the last in France to accept reconciliation, and they accepted the Franco-German reconciliation process only in the early 2000s. So we can see here that reconciliation is a selective process, and it has to select to whom we reconcile also. The idea that the formation of blocs during the Cold War necessitated reconciliation was less common in the self-image of civil society initiatives than at the political level. However, it was also reflected in these initiatives, particularly in Germany, and so far as they, these civil society initiatives in Germany were mostly orientated towards the West. This imbalance was less pronounced in the UK. One British participant who had taken part in a work camp organized by the Quakers in Berlin in 1952 regarded the anti-communism of the Germans as an obstacle to international reconciliation. The West Germans, he said, unfortunately formed a bloc, and some of us were trying for tolerance and understanding, were accused of being communists and wanting to hide the fact. The Western orientation of many German reconciliation initiatives is also part of the self-positioning in the European Occident, in German the Abendland, or in the circle of, I quote, cultural nation or civilized nations that many Germans of the first post-war years repeatedly insisted on. In their eyes, this circle included France, Great Britain, and the US in particular. By invoking such formulas like the Abendland, the Germans clung to the traditional Western superiority. This had been exacerbated by the racial ideology of the National Socialists and lived on in large sections of the German population for a long time after 1945. The Polish Germanist Anna Kochanowska-Niborak has traced how this made reconciliation between Germans and Poles more difficult. When even in 1970, when Willy Brandt kneeled down at the memorial of the Warsaw Ghetto, for example, the majority of the German population considered this as inadequate. And some even felt humiliated by the fact that Brandt kneeled down before Poles or in front of Poles. Religious motivation was another factor that was absolutely central to the early reconciliation initiatives. The political myth of post-war reconciliation generally ignores this today, and historical research has not yet given this fact the attention it deserves. Until the 1960s, religious motives determined the vast majority of all reconciliation initiatives. The Christian doctrine of reconciliation played a decisive role in making the idea of national reconciliation conceivable in the first place. As the example of the Aktion Sühnezeichen shows, it was also able to trigger the desire to come to terms with the German or the Nazi past. Keeping this in mind is important for understanding European post-war history. In historical research, however, the question that has hardly been asked so far is what followed from the fact that religious motives for reconciliation lost importance in the last third of the 20th century. In the years around 1968, for example, some British youth who had participated to a work camp in Germany expressed disappointment when evaluating the camp because, in their eyes, there had been a lack of endeavor to form a genuine, quote, genuine Christian community. Without wanting to generalize this experience of loss, it shows that an important common value that had motivated and facilitated reconciliation until then was breaking away. The European Reconciliation Initiatives after 1945 focused primarily on encounters. The approach was realized in state visits, student exchanges, work camps, and town twinnings. This seems so familiar to us today that we hardly question it. However, encounters are only one path among others that can be chosen for reconciliation. To name just one different example, we could refer to the duel of the 19th century, which, as Ute Frebert has shown, fulfilled the function of a practice of reconciliation among the German nobility. Other reconciliation practices include apologies, reparation payments, or gifts. These can also be found in reconciliation initiatives after 1945, but they were mainly chosen when facing victims of the National Socialist persecution or war crimes. In contrast, they were not the main focus for overcoming national enmity. The organization Aktion Sühnezeichen, which I have mentioned before, and which was founded in 1958, was an exception here. But it was strongly opposed by many Germans. And the Aktion Sühnezeichen, the aim of Aktion Sühnezeichen, or the special feature of Aktion Sühnezeichen, that its aim was to make a gesture of atonement. Sühnezeichen in German means atonement, sign of atonement. But even Aktion Sühnezeichen, who was the only, or for a long while, the only organization who had this confession of guilt in its self-understanding, even this organization did not reject the practice of reconciliation through encounters. The question of why so much hope was placed in encounters as a means of reconciliation after 1945 is entirely justified. After all, encounters do not guarantee reconciliation. On the contrary, they can be a complete failure and deepen misunderstandings or prejudices. Traveling abroad and getting to know foreign cultures was even explicitly praised in nationalist circles in the period before the First World War, as a means of experiencing the superiority of one's own culture. So why were people convinced after 1945 that exchange could generate mutual appreciation? Several reasons seem important to me here. The expectation that mutual ignorance would generate incomprehension and discord, and that conversely, encounters would promote mutual familiarization and, as a consequence, understanding and cooperation, was already widespread in the 19th century, but on a national level. It can be found, for example, in the idea that military conscription was a school of the nation, bringing together young people or young men from all region and social classes. For the national community, which, as Benedict Anderson put it, only exists as an imaginal community, due to its large size, the feeling of mutual ignorance was obviously perceived as a threat. Therefore, towards the end of the 19th century, encounters were also touted as a means of overcoming the class divide. For one example of this is the British settlement movement, which was based on the idea that metropolitan segregationist tendencies were an important cause of class antagonism, and that it was therefore necessary to create direct meeting places to bring university graduates together with the working class. In Germany, the labor camp movement, initiated by Eugen Rosenstock Husse in the interwar period, took up the same idea. It was not until the turn of the century that the hope of promoting understanding and peace through encounters began to take shape on a transnational level. Shortly after the turn of the 20th century, the first organized pen friendships and student exchanges were established. Some of their supporters explicitly promoted them as a means of reconciliation. In the nationalist climate of the time, however, they were often criticized. The same was true of the International City Congresses, which also propagated their transnational exchange as a work of peace. After the First World War, the international work camp movement emerged which was intended to promote peace, not between classes, but between nations. And also this organization at that time had still problems to gain understanding from the wider public. After 1945, this changed now. At that moment, we find a strong political willingness not only to promote meetings between monarchs, presidents, or government representatives, but also to allow broader sections of the population to engage in dialogue. This was based on the democratic idea that securing peace can only be sustainable if it is supported by a majority of the population. On the Allied side, this idea went along with re-education goals. In addition, the Western Allies had come to realize that the harsh reparation demands after the First World War had been a mistake. They had not led to a stable peace. As a consequence, it was now assumed that a peace agreement negotiated at government level but not recognized by the majority of the population was not sufficient to create a lasting peace. The hope that encounters would promote peace was based on the idea that such contact would emphasize commonalities and push divisive issues into the background. This is why exchanges of choirs, sports clubs, or even administrative officials were popular. Youth exchanges were of particular importance here. On the one hand, young people were seen as unencumbered, and on the other, as still malleable and idealistic, which is why youth exchanges were expected to have a special effect. Some historians argue convincingly that the focus on young people on the German side also went hand in hand with the desire to leave the past behind and to emphasize the new beginning. While encounters were seen as indispensable for reconciliation, this was not necessarily accompanied by the idea that the National Socialist past and the war were discussed in the context of these encounters. In the case of the work camp movement, we can see that the Nazi era was certainly the subject of lively discussion among participants in the first work camps in the late 1940s, but that these discussions faded into the background already in the 1950s. It is well known that the metaphor of drawing a line under the past, the famous German Schlussstrich, played an important role in the political aspirations of many Germans after 1945. It was also repeatedly emphasized as an objective of reconciliation. Thus, on the occasion of Queen Elizabeth's first state visit in May 1965 in Germany, one could read in the German newspapers, I quote, "For the British, the Queen's visit to Germany really does draw a line under the past of the war, the last war." This hope also applied to the reconciliation initiatives at the local level. The Honnefer Volkszeitung was only too happy to quote in 1975, for example, that a French woman who had been imprisoned in a German concentration camp demanded during a visit by guests from the German twin town that they should all draw a line under the past and start afresh together. This is a quote from the heading, but it's once again repeated in the text. The hope of building cooperative relationships on the basis of silencing the problematic past is rarely studied in the long durée. That is, in the context of widespread conflict management and reconciliation cultures. Historian Armin Oser has worked out for the German Empire that differences of opinion in everyday life were rarely settled through dialogue. Instead, the preferred strategy was what he calls preventive silence. As far as I know, no research has been carried out into the ways in which individual reconciliation, individual, not collective, individual reconciliation was common in everyday life at that time. My own research, which is currently still very random, reveals that the topos that quarreling friends fell silently into each other's arms for reconciliation. And this topic shows that silence could apparently take the place of a verbose dialogue. The extent to which this conflict management culture was prevalent, and the question also if it was a German peculiarity, has not yet been analyzed historically. After 1945, as historian Nina Verheyen shows in her study of the culture of discussion or discussing in the Federal Republic, debates were promoted by the American occupation authorities as a means of democratic re-education. The desire for discussion reached a peak in the course of the politicization around 1968. Here too, in view of the current state of research, we can only speculate as to how this affected practices of reconciliation in everyday history. And we are even more in the dark if we want to answer this question for the transnational context. Some of the British participants in the 1968 work camp, which I have quoted above, were sympathetic to the keenness of some German participants to engage in discussions, while others were more skeptical. We still know far too little about how different and changing cultures of dialogue affected transnational exchange. However, if we want to gauge what reconciliation meant to contemporaries, it is important to dig deeper. Silence, just like talking about the past, can be a practice of reconciliation. However, by looking at the respective cultures of dialogue and reconciliation in the context of which they are to be interpreted, we have already shifted our focus from the practices to the conditions of reconciliation, which I would like to address in more detail now. To start with the obvious, the existence of formation of a community of interest or of values is central. Emphasizing the shared Christian faith in the common European culture, the omnipresent desire for peace, but also the common security interests, laid the foundations for the European reconciliation process. But the idealistic foundation is only a necessary, not a sufficient condition to set a reconciliation process in motion. I would like to illustrate the practical difficulties faced by reconciliation initiatives using the example of the Bonn-Oxford town twinning, which began in 1947 and was the first town twinning to be concluded with a German city after the Second World War. Both cities are proud of this pioneering cooperation until today, as you can see here. However, few sources have survived for the early years of the partnership. In general, we know that the ruined cities in Germany made it almost inconceivable for many people that resources were available to surpass national borders. Characteristic is the statement of a young German volunteer who had taken part in a work camp organized by the International Voluntary Peace Service in England in 1947. In the organization's magazine, she confessed, "Did I like the idea of going over to Great Britain this summer to work in a harvest camp? It is really a delicate question for a German who sees all the misery and bitterness in his own country, where there's so much need for help to go to another country." So she says, "I can't go to England when there's still so much bitterness in Germany or need to help." In Bonn, similar reservations can be still found in the year 1952. A member of the FDP, the Liberal Party, in the Bonn City Council criticized a three-week trip to England by 20 school teachers because he had heard voices from the population complaining about the associated loss of teaching at that time. However, it was not only the lack of teachers that was criticized among the citizens of Bonn, but also the costs. He continued, I fear the German original, but I have a translation which I will read. "There was an uproar among the citizens in favor of spending on such trips abroad, partly because the toilet conditions in some schools are such that parents are reluctant to let their children use these facilities. The question of costs also arose for student exchanges, which had been organized between Bonn and Oxford since 1961. In 1962, a Bonn school turned down a request from an Oxford school because it already had an exchange with Helsinki and did not feel up to organizing another one. Moreover, during the years of reconstruction, many families simply lacked the space to host a guest from abroad. as late as in 1965, the circle of those who could take in an exchange student was, in the words of a contemporary, very limited due to the often cramped living conditions. The Bonn City Council noted that this possibility was thus restricted to people from a better-off social background. Another major problem was communication. This can also be seen at the example of the twin cities of Oxford and Bonn, two university cities with a high educational standard. English had already been taught as a first living foreign language at grammar schools in Germany since the National Socialist era, when it replaced French, which had prevailed until then. However, grammar school language teaching after 1945 initially continued the tradition of the pre-war period and was primarily focused on reading literary works, while little importance was attached to oral conversation skills. In Britain, not much German was learned either. Here, French was the first foreign language. And so, although the report on the 1962 student exchange stated that there was often a lively conversation between the students, this, I quote, often had to be supplemented by hand, foot, and sign language. The report concluded that, quote, above all, linguistic communication difficulties can make a youth exchange very difficult if too few interpreters are available, end of quote. Poor language skills could also lead to misunderstandings or even become a point of contention. We do not know in detail how well the Bonn students spoke English at the time. However, from their point of view, the Oxford students' knowledge of German was even worse than their own knowledge of English. On the German side, this could lead to expectations remaining unfulfilled. In 1965, for example, the Bonn City Council criticized the English participants. I quote, although there was a certain knowledge of English on the German side, it would have been considered appropriate if a certain effort had been made to speak German on the English side. On the German side, it was expected that there would be a real encounter. Such a real intellectual and human dialogue was not possible for linguistic reasons and because of the different interests of the visitors. When and to what extent the conversational skills of exchange students improved over the following decades is hardly analyzed in historical studies on reconciliation after 1945. It can be assumed that the level slowly improved with the expansion of education, of higher education, and a change in language teaching didactics. Especially for English as a foreign language, the spread of pop music also played a role here. Reconciliation initiatives were based on certain expectations, as we have seen here, and if these differed, this could lead to failure. In the 1960s, the dividing or diverging expectations on both sides severely tested the exchange between Bonn and Oxford and the town partnership. The Bonners literally felt a certain annoyance as they perceived the young people from Oxford as having, I quote, obviously only come here for touristic reasons and only had all kinds of amusements in their minds. The Germans concluded that this had stood in the way of a genuine exchange of opinions and experiences. Finally, there was, I quote, a scandal in the youth hostel because the young people from Oxford had apparently not adhered to the prescribed rest periods. In view of this experience, the following year, the city of Bonn disappointed another youth group from Oxford, who had to visit the city because the youth hostel was now ruled out as an accommodation option, but no suitable alternative was available here. After this cancellation, the Oxford City Council doubted the seriousness of Bonn's interest in the exchange and the town partnership and wrote to Bonn that it therefore also wanted to abandon the idea of an already planned exchange of city officials. In an agitated reply, Bonn endeavored to confirm the great interest in the partnership and to explain once again the situation that had prevented the youth exchange. The episode illustrates the difficulties of communication at a time when contact had to be made primarily by letters. Such difficulties were not uncommon for early town trainings. We can find that for other towns in a similar way. So far, there has been no research at all on how different emotional regimes affected reconciliation processes. We can see here that unfulfilled expectations could also hurt feelings of honor. The Bonn City administration drew the conclusion from the unsuccessful exchange experience that it was essential to endeavor to accommodate the young visitors to Bonn and families. What ideas of friendship and hospitality were behind this? And how did this relate to any differences in expectations in both cities? We still know far too little about this from a historical perspective, and I can't give very much more information on that. That has to be studied still, so there's a lot of work to do still. Fears is another aspect of emotional regimes, fears to be overcome, and they should be given more attention in the context of reconciliation research too. We know from Jewish travelers to Germany that simply being on German soil after the war could lead to extreme anxiety reactions. We also know that many French parents were opposed to students' exchanges to Germany. Here too, antipathy towards the Germans was probably mixed with fears. We can assume that the distance to the Nazi era, as well as the growing traveling experience with the increasing tourism, helped to reduce such fears. And that's the next condition I will speak about, tourism. The interrelationship between tourism and reconciliation initiatives is another conditional factor that requires further investigation. The reconciliation initiatives that emphasize encounters can only be adequately evaluated in relation to the increase in tourism. Research often assumes, without describing more precise mechanisms of action, that the emergence of mass tourism facilitated reconciliation. Contemporaries, however, tended to see tourism as a threat to their cause. Again and again, as quoted before, they distinguished the genuine encounter from mass tourism. But what about the participants? How many of them actually saw the exchange primarily as a pleasure trip, and how many, on the other hand, found it important that the exchange differed from a mere holiday trip? And how did such expectations affect their experiences? Did an exchange, which was one of many traveling experiences, still have the same formative effect on them in the late 1960s or 70s as it did on those for whom it had perhaps been the first experience abroad 10 or 15 years earlier? One problem for analyzing such questions certainly lies in the difficulties of finding suitable sources that can provide answers to them. Nevertheless, it is important to look for them because the media, which has reported a lot on reconciliation initiatives, distorts our view. And as I would like to argue in the next and last section of my talk at the same time, it is another important conditioning factor for the effectiveness of reconciliation initiatives. The role of the media in various reconciliation processes after 1945 has hardly ever been specifically investigated. This applies in particular to the local level. Here we can see that the media coverage was extremely selective. School exchanges and town training programs have generally been celebrated as a success in the local press with great pathos. The problems and difficulties that arose within this context, as I have shown them at the example of Oxford and Bonn, were usually ignored in the press. Some more research is done on the media coverage of official state visits. Historian Frieda Günther, for example, has worked out how annoyed the German president Theodor Heuss was with the press reporting after his first state visit to Great Britain. The German daily newspapers dismissed the visit as premature. In their eyes, Heuss had not been received with due honors in Great Britain. This was due to this photo of Oxford students standing in attention for Heuss, but with their hands in their pockets. this interpretation of the newspapers differed completely from Boris's own perception of his reception in the UK, which he described as very friendly. Boris's trip to England was an experience from which the protocol chiefs in Bonn learned. When the federal president himself was expecting a state visitor or state visit from then on, as Simone Dirix has shown, great efforts were made to recruit a cheering crowd. And we can see here again example of Bonn, which was capital at the town, Queen Elizabeth, 1965, her first visit to Germany. And the town had distributed these flags to, especially to school children, but also to the general population. And there were cars with megaphones in the town to collect the people to cheer. For the Franco-German reconciliation, Adenauer and de Gaulle were highly aware of the importance of staging the political process. They underpinned their political friendship with religious symbolism by jointly celebrating a Catholic service in the Cathedral of Reims, for example. Afterwards, strong efforts were made to commemorate this as the beginning of the Franco-German reconciliation. De Gaulle presented a commemorative stone to the Cathedral of Reims, saying, "Your Excellency, Chancellor Adenauer and I have come to your church to seal the reconciliation between France and Germany." In the following decades, monuments and coins and medals and stamps were organized to continue and to keep the remembrance of the Franco-German reconciliation alive. They helped creating the myth of the Franco-German friendship, which I have mentioned at the beginning of my talk. I'm coming to my conclusion. When the Élysée Treaty was signed between the Federal Republic of Germany and France in January 1963, many British and German observers criticized the fact that this Franco-German alliance had negative consequences for Great Britain and for the British-German relation. It was because it strengthened de Gaulle and France, and de Gaulle, whose negative position at that time stood in the way of Britain joining the European community, which was at that time still the aim of the British. Today, Franco-German friendship is celebrated as a historical achievement. There's no similar master narrative for Anglo-German or German-British friendship. Yet, contemporary voices suggest that from an everyday perspective, many Germans found it easier to establish friendly relations with the British than with the French. This observation illustrates how strongly our perception and evaluation of reconciliation processes is determined by the political level and especially by the political staging. In my presentation, I try to show that focusing on the political level is not enough to investigate reconciliation processes in democratic societies. If we want to understand how they work, we must not only include civil society in their analysis, but also ask about cultures of dialogue and conflict management and about emotional regimes, as well as for the changing economic conditions. The master narrative that post-war reconciliation was a reaction to the experiences of the horrors of the Second World War is sometimes continued for our present day in such a way that these horrors have been forgotten by now, and the work of reconciliation has been jeopardized as a result. This thesis needs to be modified because, firstly, the will to reconcile is not an inevitable experience of extreme violence. Secondly, the willingness for reconciliation after 1945 was partial. It was strongly orientated towards the West, particularly in the Federal Republic, and it had a pronounced Christian religious motivation. And it was also an elite project that tended to exclude educationally disadvantaged groups, such as by assuming language skills. This thesis, therefore, overestimates the sustainability of European reconciliation after 1945, just as it ignores the numerous misunderstandings and problems that were its constant companions. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.